Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Depending on what we were doing, and we supported the slicks.
Yeah.
When in LZs before and after and stuff, prep the LZs and defoliation missions. Those are always exciting missions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's about it. I probably just covered 1,000 things in a couple of paragraphs, but I.
Welcome to the Damcasters, brought to you in association with the Pima Air and Space Museum. I'm your host, Matt Bone. Welcome to one of our dedicated Pima Air and Space Museum interviews, and this one's a bit of a cracker, as we are joined by the fantastic Mike Cusick. Now, Mike's career has spanned, five decades now on helicopters, or whirly death machines, as they're known in our house, and Mike's story is quite remarkable. He joined the Army during the 60s and ended up on Huey gunships, the fantastic UH-1H. And he was down in the Delta for most of his time in Vietnam, right through to the end of that conflict. He would stay in the Army, in the reserve, flying Hueys for the Coast Guard, and he would never really stop, despite even being a policeman on the side. When the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq happened, he would find himself out there on the UH-60 Black Hawk. And he would be involved in a very famous rescue for a special ops mission that went horribly, horribly wrong. Mike is fantastic fun, and I really hope you enjoy what you're going to hear from our chat. We're even going to have a walk around of the Huey gunship that's on display at Hangar 1 at Pima. But there's a couple of things to throw in. First, we recorded this in the boss, Scott Marchand's office, and I think it's bugged because the microphone was picking up this weird clicking thing. It's not terrible, but it's there. I'm sorry. I always try to let you know when there's a little bit of audio quality issues. The other thing is, when we say Huey gunship, we of course mean the UH-1, which is quite funny. When we say slick, that means the unarmed version of the Huey, which would have all the troops in the back. We don't necessarily say Black Hawk. We will be saying 60s, because that's how Mike referred to the Blackhawks as well. There's a few other acronyms in there. And of course, SOL, you can figure out for yourself, but that does get mentioned once or twice. So we start at the beginning and ask Mike how it all started. Why did he end up in the Army on Hueys?
My parents were career military Army. When I was born, my father was in Europe. And my mother gathered up all the kids, and we went to Germany to be with my dad. And I pretty much my whole life was spent moving from place to place, mostly in Europe and the Far East and stuff. And when I was a freshman in high school, we moved back to Massachusetts. It's just a coincidence that we went back to Massachusetts. And my father retired there, and I started a high school near Fort Devens, Massachusetts. And when he retired, we moved to another town. So I moved in my freshman year of high school to Groton, Massachusetts. And that's where I spent my high school years. And so that was probably the longest I was ever in one place, was that 3 years of high school. And when I got out of high school, my parents wanted me to go to college, and I didn't want to go to college. I pretty much hear that story everywhere a lot. I wanted to go in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd always wanted to get in the military. I always wanted to be a pilot. I always wanted to fly, of course.
Yeah.
Everybody wants that. And so I went to college to appease my parents, and my father said, go one semester, and if you don't like it, you can go join the military. And I think he assumed that I would love being at a party college, Cape Cod, in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. But all I could think of was joining the military. So I went one semester and then joined the military.
We had to deal with that.
I wanted to be a pilot, but the Air Force and the Marines and the Navy said my eyes are too bad, and I didn't have enough education anyways. Mm-hmm. So the Army recruiter, my father said, join anything but the Army. So I went to the Army recruiter, and he said, oh, they can make you a helicopter pilot. And I said, what's a helicopter? I want to be in a real plane.
Yeah.
And he said, trust me, you'll love it. It's great. So I said, okay, and I joined the Army and went to basic in Fort Dix, New Jersey. And then I went to Fort Rucker, Alabama, and I sat in the barracks for about 2 weeks. All the other people that were with me were going off to the different places around the base, and they came and told me, your eyes are too bad, you can't be a helicopter pilot. And I said, well, then I got a signed contract, and they said, yeah, but we'll make you a crew chief. At least you can sit in the back. And I said, why not? And then I sat in around for another week or so on KP duty, and they came up and said, we have a deal for you, we'll send you to air traffic controller school. And I didn't know what that was, but my dad said, do it. Mm-hmm. And my older brother, who was an officer in the Air Force, said, do it. So I went to air traffic control school in Keesler Air Force Base, and I really wasn't real fond of it. To me, it was boring.
Yeah.
You know, when you're 18 years old, who wants to be an air traffic controller? But I went through the school, and when I completed the school, and there was a class of 32, and they sent the first two in the alphabet to Anchorage, Alaska, and the other 30 to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to go to Vietnam. And I was one of the two who got sent to Anchorage. And I tried to swap with somebody, but, you know, the military doesn't just swap two people like that. So I went to Anchorage, and the day I got there, I asked for a transfer. And I spent 6 months in the tower at Fort Richardson Army Base. And after 6 months, I got a transfer. I got sent to Vietnam as an air traffic controller. And when I got there in January of 1969, I went to a control tower and sat there, and I was bored to death. I absolutely hated it. I was just sitting there like an Anchorage watching planes take off and land. People come from places and go, and I hated it. And I'm going to say I lasted a couple of weeks, and I just told them I quit, sent me back to the United States. I don't like this. And they said, you can't quit. It's the Army. And I says, you don't understand. I hate you, and I hate this job. And so we're going to teach you a lesson. We're going to send you over there to that unit, make you a gunner. I said, oh, no, no, please, please. And they sent me, and I loved it. That's exactly what I wanted. So I started trained as a gunner, and I actually, what they did initially was put me in the hangar.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent several months in the hangar doing various types of maintenance work and learned the job OJT.
Yeah.
And then they put me over, and I got moved to a slick platoon of UH-1Ds and mm-hmm. some Hs as a gunner. And I learned the job between the hangar and learning OJT job with my crew chief. I learned to be a crew chief.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people transitioned from gunners to crew chiefs if they wanted, and they had the ability and stuff. And that's what I did. And I spent about 6 months as a crew chief in a slick platoon.
What's a slick platoon?
It's a platoon. It's a helicopter. We had two platoons of nine helicopters, mm-hmm. D models and some H models, that were mostly for troop transport and supplies, reconnaissance,
mm-hmm.
Missions like that. And that's what I did. And then It was all in the Delta. I was in the 121st Aviation Associate Company in Sac Trang, Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And it was the southernmost American aviation unit in Vietnam. And we worked almost exclusively with Arvin troops and Montagnards, special forces. Very little with real large Army, U.S. Army units. And after about 6 months, I had the opportunity to go over to the gun company unit, which is what I really wanted. I mean, I liked the slicks, but the guns was the ultimate.
Yeah.
So I went over there and became a crew chief as a on UH-1B helicopters, mm-hmm. as a crew chief, and I spent 6 months there. And then our unit disbanded in December of 1970, and I was set to come back. I extended for 6 months, mm-hmm. and I was set to ETS in September of 70. And I would have extended again, except the unit was being disbanded. Mm-hmm. To be perfectly honest, we were very close.
Yeah.
We were like brothers, you know. Nobody really wanted to be disbanded, but everybody was going to be sent somewhere different, so I just ETS'd and got out of the military.
Okay. And so what does a crew chief do? I suppose that's the next question. It's a name we know, but yeah, what's the day job? What do you get out to?
Well, for one thing, I think of him as a flying mechanic.
Okay.
And that's one of the issues, the mechanics part. And he sits behind the pilots. There's times where during test flights and stuff, he might be up front with one pilot, but generally his job is behind the pilot. Mm-hmm. And in a UH-1 in Vietnam, your main job was the observation part and the weapons, mm-hmm. and to keep the weapons operating. And you had we had, I'm going to say, six gunships at one time, and it was either the 50 calibers or miniguns and or rockets, mm-hmm. and then the crew chief and the gunner in the back had M60s, and your main job was observation and keep the helicopter safe on the left and right, mm-hmm. and keep everything operating. It was busy, you know, and it was real crowded in the back of the aircraft. There wasn't a lot of room in the Bree model with all the miniguns and all the ammunition and stuff, and it was exciting. It was fun. I enjoyed it, you know. We did a lot of good missions in the slicks, to where you go out in the boonies and work with the special forces and stuff. That was always fun, a little eerie sometimes, because you could be gone somewhere and nobody know where you're at, and if you never came back, oh well.
Yeah.
You never know where you're at. But with the guns, we worked mostly in twos or threes, mm-hmm. depending on what we were doing. And we supported the slicks,
yeah.
when in LZs before and after and stuff, prepped the LZs and defoliation missions. Those are always exciting missions. Mm-hmm. And I think that's about it. I probably just covered 1,000 things in a couple paragraphs, but a lot of maintenance stuff, maintenance work before and after, getting it ready. And when you'd land in the afternoon or the evening, you'd be up there till midnight working on the aircraft, so it'd be ready the next day. But that's part of the job. And everybody worked together. The gunners stayed around after their guns were done to help out. And the pilot, not always the co-pilots, but you had a gunner, a pilot, and a crew chief on the same aircraft generally. And the pilot would stick around to help too, to help you at night. So it was a close-knit crew. You lived right next to the helicopters. Mm-hmm. So your whole life was pretty much the helicopter and your hooch there, you know,
yeah.
and the hangar. And
so you had to take care of it, so it took care of you, because it's...
Right. They're very old. They originally came to... Our unit came to Vietnam in around 1961.
Mm-hmm.
And they were flying the CH-21s.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 62 or 63, they transitioned to the B model, which was a troop carrier, but then became a gunship later on. But they were very old. I was there in 1969, 1970, and they were still ones that were still flying, were there, and they were old, and they had stress cracks everywhere, and sometimes you'd have to bounce it off the ground to get moving, you mm-hmm. know. But so if you took care of them, they took care of you. They didn't have a lot of power, but they did the job.
Yeah,
you know.
So with such an old helicopter like that, what are you looking for when you're doing your checks on it? Because I suppose there's a, you know, saying
it would have a lot of wear and tear on it, but...
It's like everything in the aviation industry, there's checklists for everything.
Yep.
And you have a checklist to go through when you start at one place on the aircraft, and you go around the aircraft, and after a while, you obviously didn't need to look at the checklist, but it's there, and you have to make sure you get everything done, just like the pilots have a checklist before they fly. And it's pretty much a standard routine. You'd watch for wear and tear. If something looked like it was wearing too much, you'd start watching it closer and maybe change it out. That's what you do at night, is change the bearings, you know. In 25-hour, you change the oil, and at 50 hours, you have a 50-hour check and 100-hour check. Even in the regular civilian world, you still have the same routine to do in the combat zone.
Yeah.
In fact, it was even more important, some stuff, because of the stress they went through. But, and you know, the aircraft were worn out. They were old. they weren't dirty, but they were old-looking. You know, they were worn, they did us well. We didn't have very many accidents that were mechanical, you know. And anytime we had accidents, it was because somebody got shot down for some reason. And otherwise, they were good. They were good, dependable aircraft. They're good, dependable today, you know. And
when you're on the gunships and you're escorting in the slicks to an LZ, what sort of preparation to the LZ would you be doing? Because would they be holding off and you'd be going in first, or would you all be going in together? But you'd be,
well, we go, usually the gunships go in first, and they, depending on what they expect, they go in to see if there's bad guys in there, and try to root them out, try to get them to show themselves. Yeah. And a lot of times we'd have a flight of three, we'd have one or two down low to draw fire, and then when they'd catch fire, the one up above would come into that area. First thing you do, as soon as you hear the pop of gunfire, you pop a smoke and throw it out, and then you coordinate somebody going to where that smoke, where it is from where the smoke was. Yep. Obviously, you're past the point by the time the smoke hits, and we had a lot of air support, mostly South Vietnamese Air Force would support us too, and we'd prep a location, see if there's how many bad guys, if they're really there. Most of the time they wouldn't be smart enough to keep quiet, at least in the Delta, to not show themselves. They'd show themselves, then we'd prep the area where they were shooting at us, and we'd find an area to bring in here the slicks in that was far enough away from that location. You know, in the Delta it's a little harder to find concealment than it is up in the northern part of Vietnam. And it's a lot of open area, but we'd prep the area, have them come in if it was possible, and if not, we'd have the Air Force come in and do their prep and bring them in, then we'd hang around. Depending on what they wanted, we'd hang around all day. We'll take shifts to have air support for the troops on the ground. Or we'd park a distance away that's safe and sit there. Sometimes we'd sit there all day and wait.
Okay.
And nothing would happen. Other days, they'd have us there all day, prepping areas in front of them because it'd be have so much resistance. But every day was different. Spent a lot of time sitting in little Vietnamese villages next to villages, waiting to be called. And before the rotor stops, you'd have 50 little kids gathered around your aircraft, you know, and they'd have their hands out for sweets or gum, you know, and stuff like that. And that was always fun. But the people in the villages, they're always, our experiences had, they were always nice to us, you know, and treated us very well. And the Vietnamese military that we dealt with was very nice. And we had Vietnamese pilots would come in and train with us, especially as time went on toward the end, more and more Vietnamese pilots. In fact, they eventually took over our aircraft after I had left for a couple months. And so they really owned the aircraft, and we just left people there as advisors. And I guess that's about it.
So what did you do after that? You returned to the States, and what happens to someone who comes home? And
well, I did not want to be back in the States. I wanted to stay there, but it just wasn't happening. So I was pretty depressed when I got home. And I just sort of bummed around for 6 months, and then a friend told me about a job opening in the police department. He was a police officer as a dispatcher, and I figured I got to do something in life. So I went to work for them, and I found out that cops were human beings. And I really liked all of them. I got along good with them, and I went to started going to college for law enforcement. And so I worked as a dispatcher at night and went to college during the day, and I got an associate's degree in law enforcement. But I couldn't get a job as a police officer there full-time because of my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time in 1971, you had to have 20/20 vision to be a police officer.
All right.
A full-time officer.
Yeah.
You could be part-time the rest of your life. So I talked with the counselor at school, and he said, well, how about, and I wanted to get out of the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd been to hot climates and cold climates, and I liked hot climates. So he said, well, how about University of Arizona?
We say that. It's freezing today.
Well, yeah. I forgot my heavy jacket. And I meant to bring it. I was hoping we were going to have to sit outside. But I came to Arizona as a student, mm-hmm. University of Arizona. And I started going around to local police departments. I had no intentions of being a cop. I wanted to get my bachelor's degree first. And I went around and did some interviews because that's people told me that if you want to do good at interviews, start taking them.
Yep.
You know, auditions like an actor.
Yeah.
So I, the first place I went to was the Pima County Sheriff's Department here. And I did an interview on Wednesday, and they called me on Friday and said, can you start Monday? I said, what? And they said, yeah, somebody just dropped out, and you've got some experience back east. So I ran out and borrowed some money to buy the uniforms and all the equipment, because you bought it all yourself at that point, at that time. And I showed up Monday, and I guess I dropped out of school. I kept one class with astronomy because I liked it so much, and I managed to be able to keep that class at night. But for all practical cases, I had dropped out, and I went to the academy and worked for the Sheriff's Department for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, 10 years after I got out of the active duty, it was 1980, it was... I felt I needed something more. I don't know what it was. And mm-hmm. I saw a UE fly over one day. And so I mentioned that to a friend. He said, oh, that's the Army Guard unit in Phoenix. I said, they have UEs? He says, yeah. So I drove up there one day on my day off and talked to them, and they hired me. So I went in the Army National Guard in Phoenix, and I spent 10 years driving up there.
Mm-hmm.
And as a crew chief, again, I spent some time in the hangar, and eventually I became a crew chief and on UEs.
Mm-hmm.
And... some of them were so old. One of them was, did you ever read the book Chicken Hawk?
Yeah.
One of our helicopters was the Chicken Hawk helicopter.
Really?
It had the tail number and the bullet holes and the tail boom in the same place. That was pretty unique. People loved to fly that. But I was there for 10 years, and then they transitioned to 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody who was within 10 years of possible retirement, they weren't going to send them to school.
Yeah.
So they told everybody, like my situation, you have to go find another job if you want to stay in the Guard. So I came down here and went to the 305th Rescue Squadron at Davis-Monthan.
Mm-hmm.
And they had H-3s. And I interviewed with them, and they hired me the next day as mm-hmm. a reservist. So I left the National Guard on Saturday and showed up Sunday here. And I spent 20 years with the reserves. Mm-hmm. And they transitioned to 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And right when I got there, they were starting to transition. So I was in HH-60s for 20 years with the reserves, and then I had to retire because I aged out.
Yep.
And but when I retired from the Sheriff's Department in 1990, I took a full-time job with the reserve unit as an air reserve technician.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent another 10 years as a reservist at night and then a technician during the day. And then I aged out, so I had to leave the reserves, but they rehired me the next day as a civil service
mm-hmm.
employee, and I just did the paperwork.
Yeah.
And I was mostly a paper pusher, and I was in standardization and evaluation
the
most of the time. So I kept doing the paperwork side of that, testing,
yeah.
you know, and paperwork that nobody likes paperwork anywhere in the world, you know. But when you get to be my age and you want to hang around aircraft, you got to do what you got to do. So I stayed around there another 2 years, and then my wife ordered me to retire. So I retired, and then I joined the Coast Guard Auxiliary.
Yeah.
This so, was something to do. So.
What's the, after all those years with Hueys, what's it like transitioning to a Black Hawk?
It wasn't bad for me because it was bigger
mm.
than a Huey, whereas everybody in the 305th Rescue hated it because they went from a big helicopter you could move around in and put a hot tub in there. This little tiny squatty thing that was ugly and didn't look like it would fly, period. Aerodynamically, it was, how can that ever fly, you know? So most of the people weren't happy with it, but they accepted it. Okay. Once they, a year or two in, when they saw how much power it had and what it could do, they got to like it, you know? And everybody loved it after a time because it's a great helicopter. You know, it's terrific, and they're just, you can't beat it. As much as you can fit in there, you can pick it up, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And everybody pretty much liked it. It's still there. The helicopters that we got in 1992, I believe, are still there. They still have the same five of the six. And they're running great. They're going to last forever. They keep upgrading them, you know.
In the rescue units, you're working with the parajumpers going and things. Those missions always seem, for someone who's ever been in the military and has experienced at arm's length, that must require a lot of training to make sure that those guys are able to get and
constantly, yeah, every day. But you know, the strange thing is, there's a little awakening. Everybody has this epiphany that they train, and when the real thing happens, you do the same thing you didn't train, and afterwards you went, it's the same thing I always do, you know. And that's how it was with a lot of the people there. And you train, and mostly we were special ops to begin with, but after a couple of years, they changed us to rescue. Mm-hmm. And in rescue, there's not as much warp. You go, and a lot of times you sit there, yeah, and wait for somebody to crash, and it doesn't happen that often. But when it does happen, and you go in, and you do it, and you get done, you think, wow, that was awesome, but I just did what I always do for training. And we did a lot of search, a lot of rescues and searches around southern Arizona and California, out in the Pacific Ocean, Mexico, mm-hmm, with special permission, we went down there. And but a lot of the people would say that, wow, their first real rescue, that was really, really cool. But I just did what I always do.
Yeah.
And that's how it was. We did many rescues right here in the Catalina Mountains and the Tortolina Mountains, people that were lost or injured, you know. And a lot of hoists and that type of thing, fast ropes and hoists and litters. And it's pretty cool. It's fun, you know. Especially we had the civilian side, too,
yeah,
helping civilian work. Otherwise, it would have been boring most of the time. Even when we went to spend a lot of deployments in Turkey and Kuwait and South America and Venezuela. And the unit goes to Africa now. They still deploy.
Mm-hmm.
Every year, and it's fun to do that. Different places, different things. You get to do good for people, you know, and pick people up. We're called rescue, but we're rescue today, special ops tomorrow, medevac the day after, you know, ash and trash the day after that. But it's all fun, you know.
Yeah.
It's all semantics in the name of what you are and what you do. It's like any military aircraft, you know.
What was life in the Coast Guard like? And I ask that because we're in Tucson, Arizona right now. And you wouldn't think there's much opportunity for the Coast Guard in these parts.
Well, my wife said I needed something to do to keep me busy. So she found the Coast Guard Auxiliary.
Okay.
Which, what the hell is a Coast Guard Auxiliary? It's a bunch of old guys that are wannabes, you know. But I said, yes, dear. So I went down and talked with the Coast Guard people, and they hired me in the Coast Guard Auxiliary. And the Coast Guard Auxiliary, which when I was 21 years old, I would have laughed and said, I got better things to do. I can watch paint dry and have more excitement. But when you're 60s, it's a little different. So I started working with them, learning, testing and stuff. And it's the same as the active duty military. You just don't get paid.
Yeah.
And most of the people are older people. And I would say 75% of the people all have prior military, and 50% of those were Navy and Coast Guard.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've been around the ocean most of their life, you know. And the only thing I ever had to do with ocean is we'd be hoisting people out of the water and off of boats and stuff, but never really living on them or anything. But at the time, we were living in the summer in Cape Cod and the winter here.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a very, very extensive Coast Guard auxiliary units in Cape Cod all around the ocean. They supplement the active duty. And you could be busy 7 days a week if you wanted doing stuff that for the active duty.
Yeah.
And we'd take over the radio station. Their radio is 24 hours a day. We'd supplement that for them. We had people that went and were the cooks when their cooks were gone, and did a lot of water work where they would practice dropping people and supplies, and their fixed wings would drop rafts and generators and stuff. Mm-hmm. They'd practice dropping them near us. We'd pick them all up, drag them in, bring them, put them in our truck, and drive them back to the base, the Coast Guard base for them. But little stuff like that that, you know, when you're young and that's boring, you don't want to do it like paperwork. But I had a great time. You're a great time. And here in Arizona, there's some very big lakes in northern Arizona. And there's Coast Guard units at those lakes.
Okay.
And people look, they don't realize it until they look close, but until they see the wards and stuff, that they're actually Coast Guard auxiliary boats. So I did a lot of work in Roosevelt and Lake Pleasant, northern Arizona. We go up, spend a weekend. And the boats, most of the boats are private boats.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, they're the people's private boats, and they get paid for gas, that's all. Mm. But they take their boats up there. We'd dress it up to look good for the Coast Guard, and we'd ride around, help people, tow people in. You know, thought they'd be drowning and stuff, but and a lot of people think we're cops. So they all of a sudden put the beers down and put their vests on real quick because they know they're supposed to have them on. But yeah, it was fun. You know, a lot of people really liked it. They enjoyed what we did for them and stuff. And I enjoyed that. And I was there until I was 70, and which was 4 years ago. And I got tired of being negative, but I got tired of being treated poorly by the administration. And so I just resigned from the Coast Guard Auxiliary. And then COVID came, and nobody did anything since then anyway. So, but I enjoyed my time there. I loved it. I loved the people. Mm-hmm. They were really dedicated, especially since they worked for free on their own time. Yeah. You know? And so that was a very good organization, but I left that about 4 years ago. So,
I'm framing this question carefully. How does a gentleman of stature and experience in years find himself in Afghanistan?
We were deployed there.
Okay.
The Air Force Reserve.
Right.
We got to, every year we did at least one or two deployments in a foreign country.
Okay.
And we did more deployments and flew more hours in our active duty squadron, 55th Rescue, that's right next to us at Davis-Monthan.
Wow. And
people don't realize that, you know. And we had probably 120 full-time employees out here.
Okay.
And then several hundred reservists. Mm-hmm. So people don't realize a lot of them that the reserves companies work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So we deployed to Afghanistan a couple times. And had some exciting times. It was fun, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And people couldn't believe that somebody my age was there, you know. I'd be walking around Kandahar and he'd be looking at me in a flight suit. What the hell is this, you know? I got some strange looks, but you know, it's fun, and I got along great with the people I work with, you know. Most of them call me Gramps or Pops, you know. But we enjoyed it. It was good. It was great to do something at that age.
Yeah.
You know, most people at that age don't get to do that.
How long were the deployments?
Well, the longest was 6 months. And usually they tried to... I'm thinking that after 180 days, your status changes, and the pay status changes, and active duty versus reservist change, so they get you out of there at 179 days. I think there was only one time we stayed longer than that, and a lot of it had to do with paperwork and technicalities and pay and retirement stuff, and they didn't want to have to pay you too much after you retired. So we spent, I would say, an average of 3 or 4 months in different locations, Kuwait, maybe 3 to 4 months, and South America and different places. But and every time there was any kind of a hurricane disaster or something in America, we were there.
Yeah.
And other than the Coast Guard, usually is the first there, but and then the Army Guard from that local area, but then we show up and assist and we do a lot of good there.
We're going to take a quick break so that we can get the latest from the Pima Air and Space Museum with Head of Collections, Andrew Bowley.
Here we are at the Pima Air and Space Museum with one of our two Sikorsky Dragonflies. Dragonfly was one of the first helicopters to go into service with the U.S. military, the Air Force, the Marines, and the Navy use them. This one was used by the Coast Guard. It was the first helicopter used by the Coast Guard. They were heavily used to kind of set up doctrine for search and rescue for the Coast Guard. So a lot of what went forward with more modern and powerful helicopters after this was all stuff that they learned using the Dragonfly. This one did do a stint on one of the Coast Guard icebreakers because they usually had helicopter support with those. It's interesting to take a look at these earlier helicopters that used World War II style piston engines. Like this one had a Pratt & Whitney R-98. So it limited a lot of the payload these types of helicopters could take. So it really was until you started having turbine engines in helicopters, like starting with helicopters like the Huey, that helicopters were actually able to start carrying larger amounts of troops and carry more equipment and more crew, weapons, etc. But this is one of the ones that started it all, like with the Bell and some of the other early helicopter designs.
To learn more about what is on display and what events are coming up at the Pima Air and Space Museum in Tucson, Arizona, please do check out their website at www.pimaair.org. Well, folks, strap in and hold tight, because I've got a podcast to tell you about that is as thrilling as a carrier landing in rough seas. So there I was. The hosts? Well, they're just a couple of old hands who've spent their fair share of time behind the stick of a Harrier. Yes, Hawker's second greatest aircraft. They're two former Marine pilots who know their stuff. Every week, they bring in fellow aviators who've danced with the devil in the pale moonlight and lived to tell the tale. You'll hear stories that'll have your adrenaline pumping, as if you're on a combat sortie yourself. Take episode 57, for instance, where Gunny, a Vietnam helicopter pilot, describes how his squadron mate literally flew a helicopter blind after being shot in the face to get five wounded Marines to safety. He did so by listening to his non-pilot crew chief's guidance. Caution! Gunny goes from tragic to laugh out loud in this show. Be prepared to pull over to catch your breath if you're listening in the car. And if you're looking to show off your love for So There I Was, they've just dropped some cool merch that'll turn heads in the mess hall. T-shirts, beach towels, the works, all sporting the So There I Was logo to get conversations started faster than a jet off a catapult. So, ready to join the flight? Forget the tray tables and upright seats. This is about the thrill of aviation. Subscribe today at sothereiwas.us. After all, as we pilots know, every great aviation story starts with, "So there I was."
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And now, back to the show. So, while you were in Afghanistan, you were involved in what became a pretty famous rescue.
I didn't know you even knew about that.
Yes, it's we don't have to dwell on it too much, but I'm sure people would like to sort of hear your side of it, your view of it from as a crew chief on a rescue mission for a special ops team that found themselves in a bit of trouble.
Well, if you want to know the real whole story, there's our pilot, Jeff Peterson, Spanky is his nickname. He's written a lot about that, and he spoke a lot about it at the Air Force Museum, U.S. Air Force Museum. He's given some talks. He'll tell you everything from beginning to end because he's a good talker. You know, he can rope you right in. It's like Chris Henry.
Yeah.
He'll just keep you there forever. But it was fun. We were, again, I hate to keep repeating myself, but we were all very close. We knew each other here in Tucson. You know each other. As a reservist or the National Guard, you also have a second job.
Yeah.
And when I was in the Sheriff's Department here, two of my people that worked for me were pilots in my guard unit.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
And so, like, I mean, there wasn't, I don't know if there was a boss or not, but I was the boss here and they were the boss there, that kind of thing. Yeah. So that's the relationship that people have. And you knew each other very well. You hung around and your families hung around. We'd go to, say, we went a lot of work in San Diego because you have to keep current on water work. And that's the closest place for water. The families would come along a lot of times. And they'd go out and sit on the beach and watch you flying off in the distance, that kind of thing. And they'd go off and have a good time while you're working. So it was a close-knit family. And Spanky, I've known Spanky for years. He's an unbelievable pilot. Everybody in the crew, we knew each other well. Mm-hmm. We knew how you thought, you know. Yeah. You had certain routines and certain calls you made. And if something was wrong, you could tell in their voice that something isn't right or something. Mm-hmm. So we pretty much, you know, it's like being brothers or sisters. You know each other so well. And everybody did a great job on that mission. We went out several each day. We went out when it originally happened and started off by searching for the SEALs. And then another helicopter got shot down trying to go in there and killed a lot of soldiers.
Because it was sort of very tight valleys, wasn't it?
Yeah. Mm. And we spent the time out there recovering the bodies and hoisting them out and stuff. And every second day, you took turns flying. And whatever happened, happened. Where the chips fell.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that the chips fell for me on the day we were doing a mission. Mm-hmm. And we're all going, yes! You know? Everybody else going, oh, it's my turn. No, it's not your turn. Now look at the list, you know, because everybody wanted to go. And so Spanky and I and the rest of the crew and the PJs.
Yep.
And we had all trained. We trained here every day for this.
Did you have the same PJs or were they?
The PJs rotated.
Yeah.
You didn't always have the same PJs. Mm-hmm. And their schedule wasn't necessarily every second day like ours was.
Okay.
And we had crew rest issues that they're very strict on. Even in the combat zone, they're really strict on crew rest. And they set it up, and we knew we tested for it. I mean, we tested what we could do in our limits and the altitudes and stuff. And it was set up really well. An Army unit went in on the ground. Mm-hmm. And they reconnoitered the area, and they made contact with the one SEAL, Marcus Luttrell. And we planned how to get in there, and we went in at night, very low. It was pitch black. We had A-10s above us and a C-130 gunship higher up. And it was, thank God they were there. They really did a good job. And stinking dark, we went in. It was pitch black. Everything worked out just perfect. Everybody in the crew was coordinated, and you know, in the last second, little things happen, and like a brownout, you know, and you're on the edge of a cliff, and the pilot didn't even realize he was on the edge of the cliff. And I'm not going to tell him because he just did exactly what he's told me. He did it perfect, and I don't know if I shouldn't say a lot of pilots wouldn't be able to do that. We have very good pilots mm-hmm. with years of experience, but I was just so impressed with Spanky and what he did, you know. And everything went fine. The PJs went out and got Marcus and this other person that was with him that had been protecting him, an Afghan citizen. And we went out and everything went fine, just like in the movies, you know, just like it's supposed to be. We came in real quick, quiet, dark, nobody could see us, did it. We had night vision goggles, obviously, and lifted off and were gone, and everything went perfect, so I couldn't ask for better, you know.
Did you need to call in anything from the A-10s or the Spooky?
They had issues on the mountains because they were coming in, and they were suppressing the area. But I don't know what problems we had. I don't think anybody even knew we were coming in.
Oh, wow.
They were so busy with probably the C-130, the gunships, and the A-10s that we just swooped in and got them and left.
So, you know. Perfect help.
Right? Yeah, everything went just like it should have, you know. And Spanky, contrary to the fact that he talks and says he was scared and stuff, he was perfect, you know? I don't know why you say that. He did a great job. So I really admire him and everybody out there. He did a great job. You know?
I've always asked this question to someone who, it's the job. They went in, it went well, training kicked in, you got the seal out, and it's great. Then you hear there's a movie coming. Did you see it, or?
Yeah, I went and saw it. Yeah. Not right away, but I did go see it. And it was okay. I mean, it was mostly it was the troops, the ground troops, you know. It wasn't a lot having to do with us, but that's okay. I mean, it's all right. We did our job. Everything's fine.
Did you like the actor? Because the crew chief, the two guys on the back getting a couple shots. Did you think he was handsome enough for you?
Yeah, it was good. I mean, you know, I always think that I had so little to do with things like that. Mm. Just a little part. I'm like a bit part, like a little actor, you know, that I can't jump up and down and say that I'm the hero, you know. I'm Mark Wahlberg, you know, because I just had so little to do with it. But everybody had a little part to do with it, and it all went together well, you know. So yeah, I thought it went great. I'm glad.
So, what keeps you occupied today? Besides coming into to Pima to chat to me, and if it's all right with you, I might drag you out to have a look at the gunship they've got in Hangar 1.
Sure.
We do a little walk around of that.
You know, I don't know if you know this, but this is just a coincidence. My Chris Henry, I got to know him because I got a call, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago from Light Horse Legacy. Mm-hmm. It's a company that rebuilds Army helicopters.
Okay.
In northern Arizona, and they got themselves a junk helicopter. They found in a junkyard up in Pine Top, Arizona, I believe it was Pine Top. They researched it and found out, just by coincidence, that was my helicopter, my gunship in Vietnam.
Oh wow!
Which I thought had been destroyed decades ago, and they rebuilt it up there. So I went up there with them and helped them a couple times, and I enjoyed it because I got grease on my fingers, like a real mechanic, you know, and had fun doing that. And they were trying to figure out what to do with it, so they started talking with Chris Henry, and he said, we'll take it. So they sent the helicopter to the EAA Museum, and it's there now on display. And they did a fabulous job restoring it. And the display they have, there's all these really fancy, every kind of jet you can think of, and every kind of plane, and World War II fighters, and F-100s, and F-4s with bombs on them, everywhere, all over the hangar, and over in the corner, there's this beautiful display of this UH-1B gunship, and it displays all over the walls, and like movies and stuff, and they did such a good job of this that he said people just come and gawk at it, you know, that it's so great. And I went up there last summer, my wife and I, to see it, and of course he treated us like we're VIPs, like he does everybody. And we were standing there looking at the helicopter, and who walks up? A family of Vietnamese. The grandparents, the parents, and the little kids walk up, and we look at each other and go, oh, this might not be good. They loved it. Their kids got inside the helicopter, they were playing with the M60s. They loved it. They had a great time. I think, jeez, that could have been bad. But what are the odds, you know, that would happen? But it's there, and it's really nice, and that's where we're going to have our reunion and have a dinner in front of that.
Oh, fantastic.
And it's that's why he was there for our reunion last year, and he did a really awesome job. They did of fixing that up and painting it and stuff.
Chris told me about all the artifacts they've got around it as well. All the little bits and pieces.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff. Yeah. And my pilot in Vietnam, who happened to live here in Tucson, donated his helmet to the aircraft, so it's hanging in the aircraft. And mine's already here.
Yeah.
And he passed away January last year, so he's not around, but he really didn't get to see it. But a lot of the guys are going to like it when they see it, I think. And, it had the original one had my nose cone on it, You could paint whatever you wanted at one time. And they were going to, they did a nose cone for that, but I didn't think it was quite, I think it would alienate a lot of the company because that one particular aircraft and the gun, the guns, that it wouldn't represent everybody. So they just put a nose cone of the company insignia, the Viking.
Yeah.
And so that represents at least almost everybody, you know.
It's not too specific.
Right. Yeah. And then Chris Henry gave me the original nose cone.
Oh, fantastic.
He presented it to me at the Urini last year, which was totally unexpected. I was totally embarrassed. I just, I'd rather sit in the background, you know. But it's really cool. It's a good widow, Mrs. Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And I got it hanging in my garage.
And fantastic.
Of course, the ones here I had hanging in my garage for decades.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
And nobody wanted them. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I came out and early 70s to try to give them the stuff, and they didn't want it here because helicopters weren't here, military, war weapons. You know, right. they were just transport stuff. They didn't have anything to do with the real military. So I just kept them in my garage, and eventually they took them, and I gave them all my, most of my pictures were slides.
Mm-hmm.
I was, you can get a slide film at the time, and so I gave them all my slides and a little memorabilia stuff I had hanging around, you know, in the basement kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so anyways, that the helicopter and the EAA museum is pretty cool, too. It's worth going for, you know. Yeah. And
well, the one here is pretty good as well.
Yeah. Well, there's another story about the weapon systems of the aircraft.
Well, why don't we wander over and you can tell me that story.
Okay. We'll turn this off.
Okay, so we've come over to Hangar 1, and we're next to a representation of one of your old birds.
Mm-hmm.
So, as crew chief, you're doing your walk around. What are you looking for as you head around the gunship?
Well, first thing you look for is bullet holes.
Yes.
So you can call the metal shop. You look anything that's broken off or stressed, because they go through a lot of stress. Mm-hmm. A lot of times they get damaged from the shells from shooting the M60s.
Mm-hmm.
The inside of the cabin would be full of M60 shells. And between that and the rockets, sometimes you'll get damage to the tail boom. You got to check the rotors real close, make sure nobody shot a hole through the rotors. And then the engine, the transmission, the gears, et cetera. Just do a normal check for anything leaking, anything loose, anything out of place. You'd have to clean the filters every day.
Okay.
And at least once a day, sometimes during the day when you land, you had to clean them off because they got so full of sand.
Yeah.
You know, they'd fought out the engine. So you have to keep that those real clean. And the oil filters and stuff, make sure they're not leaking. This is a pretty cool helicopter because everything's out in the open.
Yeah.
You can open cowlings and see everything, and you don't have to really search for it. So if something's going wrong, you can see it real quick.
So she's well-designed. You can get at what you need to get at too much messing about.
Yeah. And no computers, so no computer issues. It's just mechanical, and it works. You know, it's a jet engine. It runs good. Transmission's good. It's well built. They haven't changed a lot, the helicopters, since the very first helicopter. You know, if you look at the head on one of the first helicopters, Sikorsky's, they haven't changed that much. Mm. You know, from the 1930s. So they're a good aircraft, and it did its job. And you know, it got old, like everything gets old, and they find a younger model. You know, like the 60. Yeah. 60's a good helicopter, and so it was time. The UE was in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
And I think it had a lot to do with how the military performed in Southeast Asia with the UE. And a lot better than a truck, I think, going in on a truck. But I talked to a lot of infantry people who said, get me on the ground. I'd rather be on the ground where I can hide, you know, than up here in these. But we loved it. We enjoyed it. We had a good time.
So besides the obvious difference between this and the slick that, you know, the guns hang off the end, it wasn't intended to ever have these sorts of weapons packages on it. What was it?
Initially, no.
Yeah.
They did a lot of testing with them after the B, A and B models came into existence to see what would happen, and found out stateside that they worked quite well.
Mm.
And they had fixed wings doing a lot of that. And fixed wings can't do what a helicopter can do.
Yeah.
And so they... that's why there's so much stress on them, because they really weren't meant to do that. But the weight isn't that bad, because it's meant to carry 5 or 6 soldiers at 200 pounds apiece. So it's that way it's fine. But instead of the weight inside, the weight's outside on the frame, and which they try to minimize, but you can only do so much. So, yeah, it put a lot of strain on them, and it wasn't meant to do it, but there's a lot of military aircraft that weren't meant to have guns initially, yeah. You know? And the T-37s and T-38s and aircraft like that turned into military warbirds. But it did well, and initially this was a troop carrier. It started as a slick. And then when they got the Ds and H models, the larger with the bigger engines, they made these into gunships because they found out it worked quite well.
Okay.
And it worked out perfect until, you know, the Cobras came along and took over. And a lot of Cobra pilots said they wish they had somebody in the back on the side, you know.
Yeah.
But the Marines kept them. The Marines still have these, UEs, you know. Upgraded models, they call them something fancy now, but they're really just a UE. And so they still use them. A lot of countries do, but...
So the advantage of this is... basically your job. You're keeping lateral watch as well. Making sure that there's nothing sneaking up on you, whereas...
Yeah, they had guns and rockets that could shoot to the front. Each one controlled a different one. Mm-hmm. But to the sides, or when you're flying past them, there's no protection other than the one behind you. But if you're the last one, you're SOL, you know? And so that's why it was effective. And I'm sort of amazed they got rid of it, but more important, smarter people than me know what they're doing, you know?
You like to hope so.
Yeah, I like to hope so. I don't know nowadays. I don't know if I can say that, but
it's lovely to see it, and they've done an absolutely beautiful job with this one here.
Didn't they?
And
it's nice. Display,
yeah. Did you say your gear's here? Is it on display or
over here?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Let's go have a look, and try not to bump into the sharp edges as we.
Yeah. I think this play here is awesome. Yeah. And this is it, it used to, I don't know if it works now, but.
They got the Kilgore surfboard.
It's when they have a skit from the movie.
Oh, right, yeah, yeah.
And, but I don't think it's.
They might not have turned it on this morning.
Yeah. I thought there was a button to turn it on. I guess not. But that's cool.
Yeah.
People say, oh, that's fake and stuff. Well, yeah, but it's still cool. It was still a fun movie to watch, you know? But these were my nose cones.
Oh, right, okay.
And that was the Viking I was talking about.
Yeah.
So we changed it to a Viking. And when we were in the slicks, you could paint. You go through different company commanders, they have different attitudes. Some wouldn't let you have anything but a tiger with the aircraft number on it. And so they made me, they just get rid of our nose cones and repaint them to a tiger.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what I painted it.
Yeah.
Mostly because I was... sort of an arrogant little asshole. And I said, well, kiss my ass. I'm going to teach you a lesson. I painted it like this with the crossed eyes and the crooked teeth. And I put it on the aircraft, and I expected it to last 5 minutes. Instead, everybody loved it, and it stayed on there. And eventually, what happens was, I think most units have the same policy, is that if your aircraft crashes and the nose cone survives, the crew chief gets the nose cone.
Oh, right, okay.
So these two were mine, and I wrapped them up in brown paper, put my mother's my dad's address, and 6 months later it shows up at their house, unscathed. You know, I couldn't believe they actually made it home. And then I did the same thing with my helmet. They DX'd it and gave me the paperwork, and I mailed it home. So I had those for. I used to wear that riding a motorcycle to college, actually. I thought it was pretty cool, anyways, you know.
So, what have you got on there? You've got Blue Diamond Devils of the Delta, and then there's an M2 on the side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't remember what's on the other side. Probably a minigun. But there's the Viking on the top, and I don't know what's on the side, but I'd have to look and see. I don't remember. It's been so long. This is all just little stuff that we accumulated, a standard everyday map that we use, and we had an AK-47, but they wouldn't let me bring it home, so I just brought the bayonet home. And these are Chu Hoi money. This is North Vietnamese money that we came upon a sandpan full of people, and we had a shoot out with them and ended up getting backpacks full of money.
Oh, wow.
And the guy was a paymaster for the North Vietnamese, and he was bringing pay to the people.
Oh, right.
So
okay,
we all took a handful of the pay, and that's just for memorabilia, you know. Yeah. And it was Chu Hoi leaflets that we dropped, and to the VC, And this is funny money, we called it. That's the money you used in Vietnam.
Oh, right.
And it was MPC, it was called. So, military payment certificates, I think. So instead of using $5, you used... And each one had a different military picture on it, a submarine, a jet, a soldier and stuff. And I assume I probably got a bunch of that in my drawer at home. But that's just the money we spent. And this is a flag we captured. I got two of them in, off of VC one time, and I gave one to my best friend back home. And I just kept this one in the basement for decades until they took it here.
Yep.
And I tried to have a friend whose wife is Vietnamese translate that, and it was kind of hard to understand, but it's a celebration of some sort. It's a Vietnamese flag celebrating some event.
Okay.
And I don't know exactly what it meant. Maybe somebody who's Vietnamese could translate it better. But so I just gave this all to them, figuring it's not doing any good in my garage, you know. And stuff from that era is starting to disappear, so.
Yep.
I hope they keep collecting stuff and talking about it. Not like World War II where it's gone, you know. How many World War II aircraft are there around, you know? Hardly any.
Actual ones.
Actual ones, yeah.
Lots of ones that are rather new.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah. Well, thanks for showing us around this, Mike. That's,
oh, there's something.
Kind of, oh, we got more over here.
These are my pictures.
Oh, these are yours.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's me in the bottom left.
Ah.
And that's just one of our aircraft. This is what you do during the day sometimes. Just sit there. And that's what we're doing. We're just sitting next to a village, and that's from the picture from the gunship. And that looks like Brian Siplin to me. He was kind of short, my pilot.
And so you get to recognize him from behind.
Well, there's a long story about that, too.
But you tell me that after we stop recording.
Yeah, ask me about that after you turn the recorder off. I'll let you know. Here's how whenever we'd go to an LZ, you'd have there's four aircraft, like rotor blade to rotor blade.
Yeah.
That's what you do when you're going in to cover each other.
Ah, that's brilliant. Well, you're a dashing young chap there.
Yes, I was. But I've got a picture of me from probably late 90s standing next to a Blackhawk just like that, loading the six, the I think it was 50 caliber rounds around my shoulder. It's funny because there's different generations, you know.
Yeah. But still carrying a M60 or a 50 cal on the side of them.
But you know, it's the same as it was in World War II. Yep. Well, not the M60, but the 50 cal. They're still using 50 cals from then. Yeah. So that's one of the best guns around, like a 45. You know, they're still around, 1912s, 1911s. So sometimes the older is good.
Yeah. If it ain't broke.
Yeah, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah. There you go.
Mike was fantastic fun to talk to, and he really warmed up as we started going along. And I think you can hear when we get out to see the Huey gunship in Hangar 1, the affection he has for the aircraft. I was fortunate enough many years ago to fly in a 412, which is the two-engined later variant of it. And they are just fantastic aircraft. And as much as we joke about Whirly Death Machines on this pod, you can see it kept Mike going for, goodness, 50 years on the Huey and the Blackhawk. And he'd still be doing it now if his wife would let him. As always, I have to thank the fantastic team at the Pima Air and Space Museum for sponsoring the podcast and also for the support in setting up all of these interviews. There will be more coming. We've got some very, very interesting chats that again return us to Vietnam, but also the skies over Europe during the Second World War. As you may have heard in this episode, the ads are kicking in. So if you want to avoid them, our Patreon is there. You get them ad-free, nice and early. As soon as I get them all put together, they end up on the Patreon feed. That runs for about £3 a month plus VAT. But if you don't want to pay that, you're happy with the ads, keep going here. The only thing I'd ask, leave me a review. Let me know how I'm going. Put some stars into your podcast app of choice. And of course, tell your friends, as that is the best way to spread the word for the Damcasters. We're trending upwards, which is great. Everybody is saying yes at the moment, which gives me a nice problem for squeezing everyone in. And on that note, next week we're joined by the remarkable Dr. Philip Blood as we have one more look at
bomber, but this time we're going to be talking about being on the receiving end in Germany when we look at one of the test raids for Operation Gomorrah, which was the bombing of Aachen on the night of July 13th, 1943. So please join us for that. Until then, you can check out So There I Was as well. It's a great pod. I didn't just throw that into the middle for giggles. It's a lot of fun. The boys are great. I'm hoping to have them on. But there we go. Plugs out of the way. Take care of yourselves. Until next week, thank you so much. Bye-bye. The Damcasters is hosted and produced by Matt Bone and is a Boney Abroad podcast production. To learn more about our podcast and check out our previous episodes, head to www.thedamcasterspod.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.